Welcome to New World Notes. Today, part two of the documentary, War Made Easy. This is a fine expose of how established power uses propaganda to trick citizens into supporting and fighting indefensible wars. Edited and condensed for radio by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Last week, we focused on the propaganda tricks they use to prepare public opinion ahead of launching a war. This week we focus on the propaganda tricks they use to keep the war going, even after public opinion has turned against it. The United States has been pretty continuously at war since 1948. Korea, Vietnam, all over Latin America, Iraq, Afghanistan, now Pakistan, not to mention Panama and Grenada, to say nothing of Somalia, and our proxy wars in Angola. I don't know if any of us could find Grenada on a map, but our Marines sure shot a lot of its inhabitants in 1983, I think it was. Somebody is profiting from endless war, and it sure isn't America's poor, working class, or middle class citizens. To say nothing of the citizens of Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Colombia, Somalia, Grenada, etc., etc. War Made Easy brings the voices of Sean Penn and Norman Solomon, of every U.S. president from Johnson through W., and lots of clips from newscasts from the 1960s to perhaps 2007 when the film was released. Don't miss Walter Cronkite's oohing and awing about a bombing raid they took him along on in the Vietnam War. Alas, Barack Obama missed the 2007 deadline. Had the film been released in 2010, the filmmakers would have had some more examples to use, but they would not have had to change a single main point. So much for change we can believe in. Mr. President, I offer a new slogan, free of charge. The audacity of same old, same old. But enough of Obama and me. Let's get back to War Made Easy.
Free flows of information have been further blocked by a more general atmosphere of contempt for anti-war voices.
And among them are a group called Code Pink, which is headed by Medea Benjamin, who's a terrorist sympathizer, dictator-worshipping propagandist.
The far-left element in America is a destructive force that must be confronted.
Some Americans, sadly, not interested in victory, and yet they want us to believe that their behavior is patriotic. Well, it's not.
What? To call the president stupid, he doesn't know much about anything, that's just great. Go with Danny Glover and Susan Sarandon. You fit in perfect.
In any way, be defending a torturer, a killer, a dictator who used chemical weapons against his own people is pretty remarkable, but it's a very long tradition in the Democratic Party.
Pay no heed to the peaceniks and the left-wing rock stars. They've had their 15 minutes of fame.
These people are essentially useless. They are reflexively opposed to war. It's a principled position, but it's the wrong position, and you can't take them seriously as a strategic voice.
Millions and millions of useless people out there.
If you want to have democracy, you've got to have the free flow of information through the body politic. You can't have these blockages. You can't have the manipulation.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
The idea to blitz the capital of
there is, quote, complete confusion.
This will be a campaign unlike any other
in the senior Iraqi military leadership.
Bang, 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 bang.
Once public support is in place and war is finally underway, the news media necessarily turn from covering the rationales for war to covering war itself.
When the president decides he wants the U.S. to go to war, then the war becomes the product. Particularly in the early stages, news coverage of war is much more like PR about war.
Influencing the nature of this war coverage has been a priority of one administration after another since Vietnam, when conventional wisdom held that it was negative media coverage that turned the American people against the war and forced U.S. withdrawal. Since that time, and beginning with new urgency during the 1991 Gulf War, the Pentagon has worked with increasing sophistication to shape media coverage of war. As then-Defense Secretary Dick Cheney noted about the importance of public perceptions during the first Iraq War, "Frankly, I looked on it as a problem to be managed. The information function was extraordinarily important. I did not have a lot of confidence that I could leave it to the press."
So for the invasion of Grenada and invasion of Panama in 83 and 89, then the Gulf War in early 1991, it was like a produced TV show, and the main producers were at the Pentagon. They decided, in the case of the Gulf War, exactly what footage would be made available to the TV stations. They did nonstop briefings utilizing the increasing importance of cable television. They named it Operation Desert Storm.
Breaking news of what's now officially called Operation Desert Storm.
Good evening. Operation Desert Storm rages on.
All that sort of stuff was very calculated. So you could look at that as an era of media war manipulation from the standpoint of the U.S. government. Then you had a different era. You had the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Scores of American reporters have now joined U.S. military units in Kuwait as part of the Pentagon's effort to make any war with Iraq what the Pentagon calls a media-friendly campaign. Another part of that effort is on display at the U.S. Military Command Center in Qatar. A Hollywood set designer was brought in to create a $200,000 backdrop for official war briefings.
And tied in with that is the worship of Pentagon technology.
I've fallen almost in love with the F-18 Super Hornet because it's quite a versatile plane.
I got to tell you, my favorite aircraft, the A-10 Warthog. I love the Warthogs.
This morning around 4 a.m. local time, the first three took off. And when you're 300 feet away from them when they do it, you hear it in your shoes and feel it in your gut.
The Pentagon's influence on war coverage has also been evident in the news media's tendency to focus on the technical sophistication of the latest weaponry.
Should they have used more? Should they, you know, use a Moab, the mother of all bombs, and a few daisy cutters? And, you know, let's not just stop at a couple of cruise missiles.
The newest, biggest, baddest U.S. bomb.
We'll pound them with 2,000-pound bombs and then go in.
2,000-pound bombs in urban areas?
Oh, sure.
The plane I'm holding in my hand here, the F-117 stealth fighter, was used in these attacks significantly.
How do you steer this thing? I mean, there's no, I mean, you have a stick. Is that right?
Sure. We have a... both of us have matching center stick with left throttles. You can do
every war. We have U.S. news media that have praised the latest in the state-of-the-art killing technology from the present moment to the war in Vietnam.
B-57s, the British call them Canberra jets. We're using them very effectively here in this war in Vietnam to dive bomb the Viet Cong in these jungles beyond Da Nang here.
The colonel has just advised me that is our target area right over there. 1, 2, 3, 4, we dropped our bombs, and now a tremendous G-load as we pull out of that dive. Oh, I know something of what those astronauts must go through.
Well, Colonel, it's a great way to go to war.
And there's a kind of idolatry there. Some might see it as worship of the gods of metal.
That's the JDAM. It is a 2,000-pound bomb that is deadly accurate, and that is the thing that is allowed us in Afghanistan and will allow us in this next conflict to be terribly accurate, terribly precise, and terribly destructive.
Amazing.
In fact, even as U.S. military technology has become increasingly sophisticated with the development of so-called smart bombs and other forms of precision-guided weaponry, civilian casualties now greatly outnumber military deaths. A grim toll that has steadily increased since World War I.
During World War I, 10% of all casualties were civilians. During World War II, the number of civilian deaths rose to 50%. During the Vietnam War, 70% of all casualties were civilians. In the war in Iraq, civilians account for 90% of all deaths.
This is the beginning of the shock and awe campaign. According to one official, this is going to be the entire 9 yards.
It was a breathtaking display of firepower.
There's kind of an acculturated callousness towards what happens at the other end of U.S. weapons.
Behind the flight deck, the weapons officer, who goes by the call sign Oasis, will never see the ground or the target, for that matter. The airfield is simply a fuzzy image on his radar.
And this is another very insidious aspect of war propaganda. There's a bias involved where, because the United States has access to high-tech military weaponry, that somehow to slaughter people from 30,000 feet in the air or 1,000 feet in the air from high-tech machinery is somehow moral, whereas strapping on a suicide belt and blowing people up is seen as the exact opposite.
Within this war-friendly news frame, the Defense Department has also been successful in shaping actual war reporting. Its influence reached new levels with the embedding of journalists during the war in Iraq.
The Pentagon tightly controlled the media during the 1991 Persian Gulf War, limiting where reporters could go and often restricting access to small groups of pool reporters. This time, the Pentagon is doing an about-face. After running more than 230 journalists through media boot camps, the Pentagon is inviting more than 500 media representatives to accompany U.S. combat units to war.
Despite being widely praised as a new form of realism in war coverage, the strategy of embedding reporters has raised new questions about the ability of war reporters to convey balanced information to the American people.
U.S. Army 7th Cavalry.
Rather than being kept far away, they were embraced and smothered and participated in the process of being smothered. They were brought along, hundreds and hundreds of them, with the Marines, with the Navy, with the Army. They became, in a sense, part of the invading apparatus. You didn't have embedded reporters with people who were being bombed. You only had embedded reporters with the bombers.
Last night, a tremendous light show here, just a tremendous light show as we were watching.
And it was through the eyes of the invaders that so much of the reporting was done.
It was a gradual process of getting to know and trust each other. And for them, trusting me was knowing I would not blow their objective and get us all shelled with artillery.
People who were correspondents for the major U.S. TV networks would express in no uncertain terms that they had been bonding very closely with the U.S. soldiers.
We have a number of correspondents embedded with our troops across the region. Some
very deeply embedded in a personal way with the Marines that he's traveling with. But he does remind.
And you had correspondents saying that, you know, I would do virtually anything for them, they would do anything for me. There's all this camaraderie.
We had guys around us with guns. And they were intent on keeping us alive because they said, you guys are making us stars back home, so we need to protect you.
That's very nice, except it has nothing to do with independent journalism, which we never need more than in times of war. It was a very shrewd effort by the Pentagon to say, you want access? Here's plenty of access. And the embedding process was actually a new wrinkle in an old game, which was and is propaganda for war. That is, in a way, the most taboo, to show in detail, in graphic human detail, what's involved when bombs, missiles, mortars, paid for by U.S. taxpayers, do what they're designed to do, which is to kill and to maim.
Precision weapons and the strategic use of air power helped make the Gulf War an enormous operational victory for the Pentagon, helping it move past the legacy of Vietnam.
Well, it's a proud day for America, and by God, we've kicked Vietnam syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
In fact, if you look at the actual course of public opinion, there's been a real willingness to support wars, without exception, at the beginning. Public support for the Second World War never fell below 77%, according to opinion polls. But during the Vietnam War, public support fell to about 30%, and within a couple of years of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, public support was down to almost 30% among the U.S. population. So what's the difference? In one case, World War II, the U.S. public never felt that the war was fundamentally based on deception. But if it emerges that the war can't be won quickly, and that the war was based on deceptions, then people have turned against the war. So first the public has to be sold on the need to attack. Then, after the war is underway, withdrawal needs to be put forward as an unacceptable option.
Withdrawal of all American forces from Vietnam would be a disaster. Not
let no one think for a moment that retreat from Vietnam would bring an end to conflict.
If we're not leaving so long as I'm the president, that would be a huge mistake.
Our allies would lose confidence in America.
To yield to force in Vietnam would weaken that confidence.
Any sign that says we're going to leave before the job is done simply emboldens terrorists.
A retreat of the from the United States from Vietnam would be a communist victory, a victory of massive proportions, and would lead to World War III.
If this little nation goes down the drain and can't maintain her independence, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other little nations.
It would not bring peace. It would bring more war.
And many propaganda lines become stock and trade of those who started the war in the first place.
The party of FDR and the party of Harry Truman has become the party of cut and run.
The American people will not stand for surrender.
Cowards cut and run.
They're advocating a policy called cut and run.
That party's old pattern, a cutting and running.
If we hightailed it and cut and run.
We won't cut and run.
Cut and run.
Cut and run.
We will not cut and run.
Cut and run.
Cut and run. Cut and run. How do you respond?
We'll stay the course.
We must stay the course.
We stay the course.
We will stay the course.
And we're not going to cut and run if I'm in the Oval Office.
All a president has to do is start a war, and these arguments kick in that you can't stop it. So it's a real incentive for a president to lie, to deceive, to manipulate sufficiently to get the war started. And then they've got a long way to go without any sort of substantive challenge that says, hey, this war has to end.
Then, appealing for public support for his peace policy, Mr. Nixon said the enemy cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only Americans, he said, can do that.
The peacemakers are out there on the field. The soldier and the statesman need and welcome the sincere and the responsible assistance of concerned Americans. But they need reason much more than they need emotion. They must have a practical solution and not a concoction of wishful thinking and false hopes, however well-intentioned and well-meaning they may be. It must be a solution that does not call for surrender or for cutting and running now. Those fantasies hold the nightmare of World War III and a much larger war tomorrow.
During the Vietnam War, public opinion polls were showing, after a few years, into the early 1970s, that a majority of Americans felt the war was wrong, even immoral, and yet the war continued because the momentum was there.
Vice President Agnew's target for tonight, as he put it, was the professional pessimist. Most of those, the vice president explained, at a rally for California Republicans are Democrats. And it was all the kind of rhetoric Republican crowds have been enjoying on this tour.
In the United States today, we have more than our share of the nattering nabobs of negativism.
The same has been the case in terms of the occupation of Iraq.
The president and I cannot prevent certain politicians from losing their memory or their backbone, but we're not going to sit by and let them rewrite history.
And that's an insidious process, because often those who oppose a war are simply discounted.
Congressman John Murtha, the first Vietnam vet to serve in Congress, a man awarded a Bronze Star and two Purple Hearts, choking back tears as he talked about his change of heart.
It's time to bring them home. They've done everything they can do. The military's done everything they can do. This war has been so mishandled from the very start. Not only was the intelligence bad, the way they disbanded the troops, there's all kinds of mistakes that have been made. They don't deserve to continue to suffer. They're the targets.
As an original supporter of the war and somebody known as a hawk, pro-military, inside the Congress, John Murtha, despite his credentials, he was not taken terribly seriously.
This guy is long past the day when he had anything but the foggiest awareness of what the heck is going on in the world. And that soundbite is naivete writ large. And the man is an absolute fountain of such talk.
His recommendations to pull out U.S. troops discounted by pundits.
Murtha's running a psyop against his own people and against his own military.
Alan,
wait a minute.
And yet you looked at the polls and you found a large amount of Americans totally were in his corner on this.
I go by Arlington Cemetery every day. And the vice president, he criticizes Democrats. Let me tell you, those gravestones don't say Democrat or Republican. They say American.
And almost any analysis of public opinion data laid side by side with what news media are or are not advocating in terms of editorials will show that the media establishment is way behind the grassroots. In February of 1968, the Boston Globe did a survey of 39 different major U.S. daily newspapers. The Globe could not find a single paper that had editorialized for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam.
And even when calls for withdrawal have eventually become too loud to ignore, officials have put forward strategies for ending war that have had the effect of prolonging it. In some cases, as with the Nixon administration's strategy of Vietnamization, actually escalating war in the name of ending it.
In the previous administration, we Americanized the war in Vietnam. In this administration, we are Vietnamizing the search for peace.
It's the idea that, okay, the war has become unpopular in the United States, so let's pull out some U.S. troops and have the military burden fall on the allies inside that country.
White House officials say it is obvious the South Vietnamese are going to hack it on their own.
The model is to use air power while pulling out U.S. troops and training Vietnamese to kill other Vietnamese people. And several decades later, in effect, that is a goal of George W. Bush's administration.
Our strategy can be summed up this way. As the Iraqis stand up, we will stand down.
The rhetoric about shifting the burden of fighting the insurgency onto the shoulders of Iraqi people themselves is very enticing for a president because it's a way of saying to people in the United States, hey, we're going to be out of there. It's just a matter of time.
Over the last five decades, we have witnessed a wave of U.S. military interventions, a series of bombings, invasions, and long-term occupations. Undertaken, we have been told by one president after another, with the most noble of intentions, and paid for with the lives of young Americans and countless others around the world.
What has occurred with one war after another is still with us. These dynamics are in play in terms of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, looking at other countries such as Iran, and the future will be replicated to the extent that we fail to understand what has been done with these wars in the past. The news media have generally bought into and promoted the notion that it's up to the president to make foreign policy decisions. This smart guy in the Oval Office has access to all the information. He knows more than we do. He's the commander-in-chief. The American people have no major role to play, and nor should they, because after all, they don't have the knowledge or capability to be responsive to the real situation. That was certainly true during the Vietnam War, as it was to be later, time after time. There were people in Congress who raised these issues, and they simply were marginalized by the news media, even though in retrospect, maybe especially because in retrospect, they had it right, and the conventional wisdom and the president were wrong. Independent journalist I.F. Stone said that all governments lie and nothing they say should be believed. Now, Stone wasn't conflating all governments, and he wasn't saying that governments lie all the time. But he was saying that we should never trust that something said by a government is automatically true, especially our own, because we have a responsibility to go beneath the surface, because the human costs of war, the consequences of militaristic policies, what Dr. King called the madness of militarism, they can't stand the light of day if most people understand the deceptions that lead to the slaughter and the human consequences of the carnage. If we get that into clear focus, we can change the course of events of this country, but it's not going to be easy, and it will require dedication to searching for truth.
time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us, even when pressed by the demands of inner truth. Men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? Now that is little left to build on save bitterness. We are met by deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. This way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
Martin Luther King Jr., from his great anti-war speech at Riverside Church in Manhattan, April 4, 1967, 1 year to the day before his assassination. You've been listening to part two of the documentary War Made Easy, a fine study of how the government and the media connive and lie to get the people to support one indefensible war after another, and to keep us at war once they get us in. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illigit to my non-carborundum, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao!